Hello, I'm Mark Silverman. This is number 0195, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0195. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, you'll meet Julian Montague, who's the author of The Stray Shopping Carts of Eastern North America, A Guide to Field Identification.
If you see the book, you'll see a lot of shopping carts are sort of strange positions and very strange situations, and I didn't pose any of them. As a matter of fact, when I would go to a new city to look for carts, I basically would look at a map and sort of figure out where the shopping plaza is in relationship to like some body of water, and then go there. Because if they were nearby, you would find shopping carts in the water. So what became interesting about the project was the way that it was predictable, the way human behavior was predictable in the way that shopping carts were treated. And that's true like across. It wasn't even about like poor neighborhoods versus rich neighborhoods. Like all places sort of, if you have shopping carts near water, someone's going to throw it in.
Don Dondari is the author of UFOs, ETs, and Alien Abductions. He says that ETs are out there, and as humans, we should know that they're out there.
The book I wrote is an effort to make it clear that we're onto them. Not everybody agrees with that, obviously, or there wouldn't be a conversation about this. But I think we're onto them. I think the evidence is conclusive that they're here. And how we develop in the future and how they interact with us is a really open question. We should take for granted that this is true and then think on from there. Well, that's exactly what I'm asking people to do after they finish reading the book.
Stuart Nullman is back with another edition of Book Banter.
Hi, I'm Stuart Nullman, and on Book Banter, we visit the golden age of TV variety shows with Frank Pepiat in When Variety Was King, and two other books that deal with Pepiat's long career in television. So stay tuned for it on the Stuff File program.
And there's lots and lots and lots of stuff, and of course, an idiot of the day. The guest Slater, the person who told you this was show number 0195, was Mark Silverman, who is the planning director for Critical Mass, a marketing agency in Chicago. And, by the way, he's also the former producer of my former radio show, Holder Tonight, back in the day. Thank you very much, Mark, for being the guest Slater on this edition of the Stuff File program. By the way, Mark's also the biggest Grateful Dead fan alive. Guaranteed, bar none. Thanks once again, Mark, for doing the guest late on this edition of the Stuff File program, a program that's also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Let's get right to the stuff. Well, in March, twin sisters Louise and Martine Fokins, age 70, announced their joint retirement after more than 50 years each on the job as Amsterdam prostitutes. Now, in February, the minimum age for prostitutes in the Netherlands was raised to 21, but there is no maximum. The twins estimated that they had 355,000 client visits between them, and Martine noted that she still has one devoted regular who she'll have to disappoint. Louise, though, appeared happier to hang up her mattress for good because of arthritis. The sisters complained about the legalization of brothels back in 2000, with Eastern European women and pimps out-hustling the more genteel Dutch women, and ensuing taxation, which required the women to take on more clients. Wow. 355,000 clients. You know, they should have a sign like McDonald's. You know, over 250,000 served. Yeah. Or perhaps like Burger King, have it your way. Whatever. Moving right along in a story that is totally unrelated. A 12-hour TV miniseries shown this winter on Norway's government channel NRK is National Firewood Night. It was conceived as a full series, then cut to only 12 hours, eight of which focused entirely on a live fireplace. Now, nearly a million people tuned in to the series, and at one point, 60 text messages came in complaining about whether the wood in the fireplace should have been placed with bark up or bark down. Wow, they have time on their hands in Norway, don't they? Yeah. Said the show's host, "Firewood is the foundation of our lives." A New York Times dispatch noted that a best-selling book, Solid Wood, sold almost as many copies in Norway, proportional to the population, as a book selling 10 million copies in the U.S. Wow, solid wood. Well, after that first story, you can insert your own double entendre with this one. But I will say that perhaps there's more meaning now to that Beatles song, Norwegian Wood. Also, a best-selling book called Solid Wood? Who would have thunk it? It's like a book about abandoned shopping carts. But I'm getting ahead of myself. That's our first guest, and that's coming up a little later. Stick around. Okay, the newest beauty treatment rage in China, according to Chinese media, is the fire facial, in which alcohol and a secret elixir are daubed onto the face and set ablaze for a few seconds, then extinguished. Now, according to an ancient Chinese medicine secret, this will burn off dull skin and also alleviate the common cold and reduce obesity. Yeah, I guess it reduces obesity because you're running so damn fast with your face on fire. But anyway, imagine the person who first suggested this, and also the various testing phases they must have gone through before this method was deemed successful. Yeah, the R&D process must have been fascinating. Okay, most of Ireland's 320,000 inhabitants are at least distantly related to each other, leading the country to compile the Book of Icelanders. It's a database of family connections dating back 1,200 years, with accidental incest thus a genuine problem. Three software engineers recently created a mobile phone app that allows strangers to bump phones with each other and know instantly whether they are closely related. In its first few days of release in April, the developers said it had already been used more than 4,000 times. 4,000 times, eh? Yep. You know, this app sounds like an interesting idea. I wonder how well it would do in the Appalachian Mountain region. Just asking. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our first guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, last year, according to Chicago's WBBM-TV, Palmin Motors in Kenosha, Wisconsin, sold a brand new GMC Terrain SUV to an elderly couple. One was 90. The other was 89, in which the husband was legally blind and in a hospice care on morphine, and the wife had dementia and could barely walk. Now, according to the couple's daughter, it was her brother, David McMurray, who wanted the SUV but could not qualify financially, and so he drove his mother from Illinois to Kenosha to sign the documents, while a Palmin employee traveled to Illinois to get the father's signature 3 weeks before Pops passed away, by the way, as it turns out. An attorney for Palmin Motors told the TV station that the company regretted its role and would buy the vehicle back. So, driving to another state to get a signature from somebody who was in hospital, looks 90, and is on a morphine drip, wasn't a clue that something was slightly off here? Really? And you know, it would be hysterically funny if Pops had managed to take Junior out of the will before he died. Yeah. Anyway, let's get to our first guest, shall we? Julian Montague is the author of a book that has an eye-catching title. It's called The Stray Shopping Carts of Eastern North America, A Guide to Field Identification. The book actually came out of a greater study done. It was the Stray Shopping Cart Project. And Julian Montague joins us on the line right now from Buffalo, New York, via Skype to Skype communications to talk about shopping carts. Hi, Julian.
Hi, how you doing?
I'm fine. Thanks for being on the program with us. Now, I came across your book, and I have to admit, the way I came across the book online was on a website talking about book titles, and it wasn't in a flattering light. I'm sure you're aware of that.
Yes, well, I mean, I got a lot of attention with the book for the title. It actually won the oddest book title of the year in 2007. I should say a little. I mean, the project is meant to be a bit odd, a bit obtuse. So the title is deliberately complicated and long.
Right.
So in some ways, I feel like I'm in on the joke a bit more than maybe some of the other authors of bad book titles are. But
the thing about it is once you delve into it, this didn't start out as a book. This started out as a study, right?
Yeah, well, it's an art project.
Okay.
So, basically, it's kind of like a conceptual art project that involves photography and text. So, I'm an artist and a graphic designer, and when I started the project, I noticed back in, I think it was 99 that I actually got started on this, got the idea. But I noticed all of a sudden shopping carts kind of everywhere in the city, like, you know, just in strange positions on lawns, you know, tipped over at bus stops. I just somehow became aware that they were this sort of urban phenomenon, which we're all aware of on some level. And I thought it might be interesting to do a kind of photo project related to it. But if I were to just take photographs of stray shopping carts and just that was it, I felt they'd only read in a really one-dimensional way. Like they'd just be this kind of sad commentary on society or something. And I wasn't interested in that. So I decided to kind of figure out what's happening with these shopping carts. Like how do they get from one place to another? Like what is the sort of rhythm of this kind of ecology that they have? And that led me into making this very taxonomy that allows you to identify shopping carts on the situations in which you find them.
I think that, again, the concept, when I delved into it a little further than beyond the title, I thought the concept was fascinating. Now, have you been in contact with, say, shopping cart manufacturers? Have they gotten wind of this? Have they found this an interesting study?
I think some people are aware of it, or people have sent emails to that effect. I don't know that, you know, I don't know that my studies would actually be truly helpful to them in any kind of management sort of way. But I think they're amused. I've communicated with people, and I think they're sort of amused with it more than anything. I deliberately did it in a way where I did not kind of reach out to stores or places that had shopping carts to get information. I sort of treated the shopping cart like it was a wild animal and I was a naturalist studying it. So like all the sort of, it was all observation. So I sort of didn't do a lot of real research beyond my own sort of tracking shopping carts.
Now, as I said, the title of the book is The Stray Shopping Carts of Eastern North America, which leads me to one of two questions. Just how broad of an area in Eastern North America did you look at? And two, are there sequels from other territories?
Well, a lot of the basic research I did in Buffalo, you know, a lot of the basic photography and sort of thinking through these ideas. I also did an artist residency in Cleveland for 6 weeks in the winter of 2005 or 2004. And then I did another project in Hartford, Connecticut. And those are the places where I really looked at cards seriously, like spent time photographing and finding them. But then I would just do other like short ones when I would travel in the East. So I mean, there are carts from Florida. There's a few from Toronto, New York, all over the place. So, you know, it's not – basically the sort of basic conditions I identify I think are pretty much true for the whole United States. But I keep it to the East because I'm pretty sure about that.
Okay.
Although I have a few Hawaiian carts also and European ones that I mentioned in the book as well.
Now, it's one thing to notice shopping carts across the landscape and go, there's a shopping cart. It's another thing to want to do an art project like this. Was there a point when you were going around taking pictures where you thought, I'm going to run out of shopping carts, or I'm not going to find enough shopping carts, or anything like that? Or were they plentiful?
No, they're plentiful. And the other thing I should say is that if you see the book, you'll see a lot of shopping carts are sort of strange positions, very strange situations. And I didn't pose any of them. Like all of them are as I found them. I never worried about that. They're always there. Like they're always. As a matter of fact, when I would go to a new city to look for carts, I basically would look at a map and sort of figure out where the shopping plaza is in relationship to like some body of water, and then go there. Because if they were nearby, you would find shopping carts in the water. So what became interesting about the project was the way that it was predictable, the way human behavior was predictable in the way that shopping carts were treated. And that's true like across. It wasn't even about like poor neighborhoods versus rich neighborhoods. Like all places sort of, if you have shopping carts near water, someone's going to throw it in. I even found like one in the canal outside the like Royal Palace in Stockholm in Sweden. I found a shopping cart there. You know, so there's this. It became interesting to follow this kind of impulse that people have to vandalize things.
Did you do any after coming up with these theories and realizing that certain patterns? Did you speak to any, I don't know, psychologists about what's the thought process? I mean, like, why are there always shopping carts in the water?
No, I didn't. I mean, and again, part of it is because it's an art project, and I'm in a way more interested in asking questions than answering them. But I think in my own thinking, I think that there's this sort of – I mean, I'm sure there were cavemen throwing rocks into the water, you know, for entertainment. And I think that's the basis of it, that sort of desire to sort of make a splash or that sort of thing. Like I think it's not a terribly malevolent impulse in general. And I should also say in the project, I sort of write this project in the voice of a character kind of who takes this very seriously. So I am like a taxonomist who's interested in – my character is this guy who really wants to figure out how to identify shopping carts, but he doesn't make a lot of other comments about like social implications or anything else. So in that way, I'm trying to sort of be like a scientist who only cares about this thing, and then the audience gets to draw their own conclusions, you know, from the sort of the information that I present.
One of the reasons I find this fascinating on two levels is, one, first, you have to come up with the idea to do this, which I just think is marvelous. I like the way your brain works. But two, you then have to convince a publisher. What was that like?
That actually was so much easier than I would have thought. So I should say that the project didn't. I mean, I showed it in art galleries and so forth, and I got a fair amount of attention for that. I mean, at the time, represented by a gallery in New York, and I had a show there, and I had also made this sort of poster that laid out my whole system as a kind of viral marketing piece. And as it happened, I was doing an art fair with my gallery in New York, and someone who worked for Abrams Books came by our booth and saw my work, and I'd given him this poster. And he approached one of his editors, who they thought it would be a great idea for a book. I'd already thought about it as a book from early on, out of the idea of a field guide. And so then I basically was asked to pitch this book, and it very quickly was accepted and sort of went through. So it was much easier than most people's experiences. So, but there's a little weird because it's an art project, but I think we're interested in it because it is in this sort of like quirky, weird kind of area that's almost more like in a humor category. So it sort of floats between categories. So it wasn't like sort of a standard art book type of thing.
Well, I guess, like I said, I think it's a fascinating idea. The Stray Shopping Carts of Eastern North America, a guide to field identification. Again, you had this out a little while ago. What have you been working on, or what are you working on now?
That project is – I mean, I don't do any new work for that project, but although the work still gets shown, it's like in gallery shows right now that are touring the West. But so my second – my big project I've been working on for the last few years is about – I'm interested in the intersection of animals and architecture, particularly spiders and insects. So it's an even weirder project about kind of the way spiders live in our houses. And that work takes a lot of different forms of photographs and I said I make these large banners that are portraits of like spider faces, the spiders that I collect, and then I sort of hang the banner in the room and then photograph the whole room. So this sort of banner becomes this kind of marker of where the spider was. And sort of a bunch of little art projects under the umbrella of this big sort of idea about the way we are always living around these other animals and the very interesting relationship.
Again, artistically, I just love the way your mind works. you have a website? People can find some of your work. Tell us about the website, where they can find it.
I do, yeah. My website is montagueprojects.com. And that compiles all of my projects. You can see all the different shopping cart work there, my more recent work, and also has like samples of my graphic design work and so forth.
Great. Julian, thank you very, very much for being on the program with us. It's great stuff.
Oh, thank you very much.
Julian Montague, author of The Stray Shopping Carts of Eastern North America, A Guide to Field Identification. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0195, and you'll find links to Julian's site, plus also links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly.
You're listening to The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. You can email him at peter@thestufffile.com or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Kelly Alexander's show is your place to be for everything to do with health, lifestyle, and entertainment. Join us as we chat with celebrities like Emmy winner Mia Michaels from So You Think You Can Dance, best-selling recording artist Taylor Dane, and world-renowned astronaut Julie Payette. We also cover important topics like breast cancer awareness and how to help your child through bullying. All this and more, please join us, www.kellyalexandershow.com.
It's The Kelly Alexander Show.
Capture your need for sound.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Have you ever noticed on some of those public broadcasting pledge drives, they tend to sound like ransom demands in a kidnapping?
Hey, your kids like this, Mr. Rogers. It would be most unfortune if, for some unforeseen reason, you weren't in the neighborhood no more.
Well, I'm here to ask for your support in a non-threatening, non-obligatory kind of way. Part of the success of The Stuff File depends on the generosity of its listeners worldwide. So if you can, and if you want, please feel free to make a small one-time donation. Just go to the website at thestufffile.com and click on the PayPal donation button. You can donate $10, $5, or even $1, whatever you'd like.
You know that big bird? That would be one huge drumstick. If you know what I mean.
If you have a PayPal account, it's an easy transfer. And if you don't, all major credit cards are accepted. Your generosity would be much appreciated in keeping this show running.
About that antique roadshow, they might be seeing a little more concrete than they originally anticipated.
No strong-arm tactics, no ransom demands. Just a simple please and thank you. To donate, visit thestufffile.com.
You're listening to The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Viewer discretion is advised. But then again, why are you staring at a radio program?
And still to come on the program, we'll talk about UFOs, ETs, and alien abduction. Plus, Stuart Nauman will be along with another edition of Book Banter. He'll review another book right here on this very show. And of course, we have an idiot of the day coming your way and lots more Stuff File news right here on a program that's also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio. I have mentioned Stitcher Smart Radio before, right? Heck, I've mentioned it already in this show several times. But, you know, you can hear this program on Stitcher Smart Radio. Stitcher allows you to listen to your favorite shows directly from your iPhone, Android phone, Kindle Fire, and beyond. Just about any mobile device that you have, you can hear this program and at least 10,000 others, not just this one, but a lot of shows, a plethora of shows, a host of shows on Stitcher Smart Radio. It's on demand and on the go. Now, if you don't have Stitcher already, well, download it for free today at Stitcher.com or go to the app stores. It's also free there as well. Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Let's get back to the stuff. We have a couple of items dealing with people unclear on the concept. John Leopold, the former county executive of Anne Arundel County in Maryland, serving 30 days in jail for illegally forcing his government security detail and another employee to perform personal errands, apparently wasted no time in March displaying a similar attitude toward his jailers. He quickly demanded that the jailers serve him a breakfast of Cheerios, skim milk, bananas, and orange juice instead of the scheduled fare. Wow. That's a piece of work, which brings me to a reminder of a nut job from overseas. You may remember last year, Anders Breivik, the imprisoned 2011 mass murderer of 77 people in Norway, who famously began a hunger strike when rebuffed over his 27-page list of demands, including internet access and a series of menu and climate control improvements that he wanted in jail. Again, I remind you, in case you don't remember Anders Breivik, he murdered 77 people, mostly kids. And he's making demands while in jail, wanting internet access and menu and climate control improvements. And he's on a hunger strike. Okay. I know I've said this before. but I think it bears repeating. Call me cold-hearted. But I've never understood the concept of a hunger strike, especially by people in prison. If it's your desire to stop eating until you get your way, trust me, I can wait. As a matter of fact, while you're on a hunger strike, I will sit across from you and enjoy a five-course meal each and every day while you voluntarily decide to wither away. And I will also burp with contentment and laugh at you. That's what I will do. So go ahead, starve yourself. See if I care. Anyway, where was I? Oh, yes, police in Oklahoma said they arrested a man accused of trying to steal a Zamboni from a convention center. Oklahoma City police said Spencer Holt, age 24, attempted to take the Zamboni from the Cox Convention Center, but was unable to get the mammoth ice-smoothing vehicle out of the building. Security guards were able to subdue Spencer, who police said was intoxicated. Go figure. The charges against Holt include destruction of private property and public drunkenness. What was he going to do, by the way, with the Zamboni once he got it out? I mean, just how drunk was this guy? I could see him decapitating himself trying to get it into his garage. And an unnamed man was hospitalized in April in Tucson, Arizona, after firefighters, finding him unconscious at 3 a.m., pinned under an SUV parked in his driveway, lifted the vehicle and dragged him to safety. A police spokesperson learned that the man was trying a stunt in which he was going to put the SUV in reverse, jump out and lay on the ground behind it, have the vehicle roll over him, and then get up and get back into the SUV in time to stop it before it collided with anything. Okay, this guy has way too much time on his hands and was almost the idiot of the day on the program. Almost. We'll get to that later. Trust me. Joseph Calhoun, age 57, a bus driver for Beeline in Peekskill, New York, apparently considers the company strict about its on-time schedule. Now, when Calhoun came upon an accident scene where medics were treating a pregnant woman who had been hit by a car, he ordered the medics to move the woman out of his way. When they refused, he grabbed a medic by the shirt and tried to move him. He just kept referring to his supervisor. His supervisor told him that a schedule had to be kept and he had to keep moving, according to Police Chief Eric Johansson. His behavior was just extraordinary. Calhoun was arrested and charged with obstructing governmental administration and obstructing emergency medical service. So, he got arrested, huh? Well, so much for being on time. Yeah. An unnamed 41-year-old man in Indianapolis, Indiana, reported to police that he had been robbed by a gang. He had met a 16-year-old girl on Facebook, and she agreed to meet him for sex. I remind you, the man is 41, and the girl is 16. You see where this is going, don't you? After picking her up at an apartment, she told him to drive to her friend's house where they would party. I'm doing air quotes here. She went in first, and he was jumped by four robbers who took his wallet, car keys, and cell phone. They then took his brand new Lexus on a shopping spree with his credit cards while three others held him. He described the seven robbers as between 14 and 20 years old. After 7 hours, he was released and given his car back. He drove home to his wife and called police. Yeah, you heard me right. He drove home to his wife and called police. He was lucky. You know, usually these teen girls are online cops, actually. They were not. Or they're usually either cops or Chris Hansen from To Catch a Predator. And by the way, since he's sharing his story by calling the cops, doesn't he get arrested anyway? Yeah. And also, how thrilled do you think his wife is about all of this? Not too thrilled at all. Anyway, time for one more story before we get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. A couple say they came back from their East Wenatchee, Washington home to find Jason McDaniel, age 38, in their kitchen. He was standing there with the refrigerator door open and feeding their dog some pudding, said Daniel Rearson, the local assistant police chief. McDaniel allegedly told the couple that he was looking for a man to kill, but they told him that person did not live there. How nonchalant is that, huh? McDaniel calmly walked out of the door, calling the dog to follow him, which apparently the dog did. No loyalty there. While he was there, McDaniel told the couple his name, and police were able to quickly track him down and arrest him on suspicion of residential burglary. The dog, by the way, is still missing. Yeah. I guess it was just looking for its chance to escape. If they're still looking for the dog, I guess one of the easy ways to find it would be to put out a bowl of pudding at the front door. Maybe that'll bring the dog back. I don't know. Just a thought. Anyway, should we get to our next guest? Yes, let's do that. Don Crosby Dondarry is a PhD who uses a critical scientific eye to research the evidence of UFOs. He's the author of UFOs, ETs, and Alien Abductions, and he joins us on the line right now from Toronto. Hi, Don.
Hi, Peter. Thanks for inviting me.
Thanks for being on the program with us. This is a topic that gets a lot of discussion and, quite frankly, a lot of snickers. Now, as I said in the introduction, you are a PhD, so you do study this from a scientific point of view. Are you rare in that case? Because a lot of scientists don't really want to examine the existence or possible existence of UFOs.
You're right. I'm not that rare. I have colleagues. In the book, I acknowledge the help of about 30 of them. About 10 or 15 of those people have PhDs. Some of them in physical sciences, others in the social sciences, and some are MDs. And the fact is that it's not just interested amateurs, but there are serious professionals who have qualifications to study this stuff and prestige on the line, if you want to put it that way, and who still think UFOs are extraterrestrial.
Okay. Now everybody has their believability threshold, and I'll tell you where mine is. I don't have any problem believing the idea that there's UFOs. Let's just use the title of your book. I have no problem with the idea of UFOs. I have no problem with the idea of ETs. I'm not so sure about alien abductions.
Well, it's interesting you should say that, because when I've talked to other people about this, I've put this in the following context. Those first two propositions, that there are extraterrestrial UFOs around the Earth, and that some of what people report as UFOs are those ET vehicles, and that some of those vehicles have crews, ET crews, I consider those established beyond reasonable doubt. Now, if you were in court and accused of a criminal act, you could be convicted on evidence beyond reasonable doubt. On the other one, the last one, have people been picked up and studied and put back down again? I consider that established on the balance of probabilities, which is the standard of proof for a civil case. In other words, if you tripped over a stair and fallen down and sued the owner of the stair, if the stair was found defective on the balance of probabilities, you win your case. So it's a less rigorous standard than beyond reasonable doubt, but it's strong enough for me to assert that it's true.
Okay. We often talk about so-called first contact. Generally speaking, why do we not hear more about first contact? In other words, if we're being watched, occasionally being abducted, why have we not been openly contacted?
Well, you might ask, why should we be openly contacted? Think about what we do when we're studying nature. We take a helicopter and we fly it over some natural habitat. We find a bear shuffling along on the ground below. We're interested in what the bear's metabolism is like, so somebody shoots a tranquilizing dart into the bear. The bear keels over. We land the helicopter, do some tests on the bear, take off again. The bear wakes up and goes about its business. We're not interested in interfering with the bear. We just wanted to learn more about the bear. So we've done what you might call minimally invasive investigation. It could quite possibly be that we're being minimally invasively investigated by characters who have better technology than we do and are interested in what's going on down here.
Okay, but going with that analogy, I'm willing to believe that for the most part, the bear population knows we exist. They don't necessarily interact with us, but they know we're there. We don't necessarily go ahead.
No, go ahead. The bears, some bears, I don't think they have much of a culture for transmitting information, like what you might call the Bear Weekly Journal, which reports sightings of helicopters. But a bear looking up might see a helicopter and know it's there. A person looking up might see a low-flying UFO, a so-called close encounter, and know it's there. who's he going to tell? His friends? Sometimes it gets to the press. These are not things that, how shall I put it, have a wide acceptance among elite culture. You're not going to get the New York Times to report that. You might get a couple of paragraphs in the Montreal Gazette, pardon me, we both read it, and that actually happened a couple of years ago when a colleague, a guy named Cleve Ziegler, who never made a secret of his name, saw a low-flying UFO over Côte Saint-Luc, reported it to the media, came to our house, spent about 2 hours talking to me about it one Sunday afternoon, and professional as he was, never made a secret of what he'd seen, and I followed that up and found a couple of other witnesses at the same of the same event. So, yeah, there's no what you might call a fishing official sighting source for UFO reports. They exist. They're unofficial. There are people who collect this information because they're members of UFO research groups, but the government isn't funding them, put it that way.
Interesting you bring up the government, because one of the things when people talk about UFOs and ETs, the other thing that usually comes up almost right after in some circles is some sort of conspiracy, and that is the conspiracy to keep information away from the general population. Do you believe governments know more about so-called UFOs and ETs than they're letting on?
Only in one case, and one of the things you try to learn if you're actually professing to be a scientist, as I am, is that you tell people what you know, and then you stop short of telling them what you don't know. I know that in the case of Roswell in 1947, there was an alleged UFO crash. It turned out after about 20 years of investigation, 30 years later, the evidence came through by multiple interviews with multiple, by this time, relatively old witnesses, that the government had actually got a crash, the U.S. government, of course, had a crashed saucer and had tried to cover up the evidence for it. I know that's true because, first of all, I've read all the accounts, and second, I know the people who wrote them, and they're trustworthy. Beyond that, I haven't a clue. And again, that's where I have to stop and say, I can't speculate because I don't know more. Now, that's a distinction between somebody who's trying to give you a story about what he or she knows and somebody who's not limited by that and is quite free to use his or her imagination. So I think there's one case, that's all.
If extraterrestrials are out there, where do you think they're from?
This I cannot possibly tell you because I have absolutely no information. I don't have any technical knowledge about that. All I can say, and this is in the news these days, so your listeners will know this, is that about every week and a half, some telescope operator is reporting discovering another habitable planet in the orbit of another star. So there are many places that might sustain the kind of life we are, namely carbon-based people living on a planet where the water doesn't always stay frozen, and that makes the possibility of other places for critters like us expand. But the answer is, I don't know. Again, that's one of those things where if I knew, I'd tell you, and since I don't, it doesn't help for me to speculate.
Okay, but well, I'll ask you to speculate in this one regard. You mentioned the possibility of other carbon-based life forms. Do extraterrestrials have to be carbon-based?
No. That was just the what you might call the most obvious case. There are other planets, apparently, where if evolution had progressed along the lines it progressed with us, there could be critters like us. But that doesn't mean at all that that's the only kind of critters there are in the universe. And again, you're getting me, quite reasonably, since it's an open question, out of my field, out of the place where I'm comfortable saying I know something about this. But sure, there could be life forms based on other biological bases. I know the guy to ask. He's a colleague at McGill, but it's not me. His name, by the way, is Hojitalle Zale.
How long, in the case of human history, do you think ETs have been around us? Would you say it goes back for a long, long period of our existence on this planet?
Some people say that. What I know, on the basis of what I've read, what I've checked out in the way of research, and the accumulating data, is that substantial evidence has been accumulating since 1946, 47. And beyond that, before that, there are suggestions, but nobody took the problem systematically seriously. From that time on, it was taken systematically seriously, and data has been accumulating. So for the last 65 years.
And the reason why I ask that question is, do you think that as we, as a society, develop further, more scientifically, that it would become harder in the future for said ETs to observe us without us knowing about it? In other words, are we becoming smarter and maybe more onto them?
Well, first of all, I think we are onto them. The book I wrote is an effort to make it clear that we're onto them. Not everybody agrees with that, obviously, or there wouldn't be a conversation about this. But I think we're onto them. I think the evidence is conclusive that they're here. And how we develop in the future and how they interact with us is a really open question. I wish I could give you a heads up on it. What you're implying, and this I like, is that we should take for granted that this is true and then think on from there. Well, that's exactly what I'm asking people to do after they finish reading the book. I want them to realize that the evidence is strong, that this is something in an open society that we should discuss seriously and bring out of popular culture where it already exists, as you well know. There are dozens of movies, dozens of television series, some of which are fun, like like Men in Black, others of which are tended to be taken more seriously. But all of that is what you and I would call popular culture. We can all enjoy it, watch it, listen to it without necessarily thinking it's true. What I'm saying is, it's true. Now we should have a conversation about what if it's true and where do we go from here? And the answer is, I don't know, but I'd like to get people talking about it.
I know we've sent a lot of things up into space in the hopes that there's something else out there, and that when we send things out, either sound waves or whatever the case may be, we send out parts of our history because we want others to know about us. I'm going to flip that question a little bit to you. And if you had an opportunity to come in contact with an ET, what would you want to know about them?
Well, first, I'd like to know where they're from, obviously. That would be interesting. Second, I would like to know what their motives were for coming and having a look at us. If it's curiosity, that's understandable. We're curious, too. And thirdly, I'd like to have some sense of what their intentions are about future relations with people on Earth, because that is a political or a big geopolitical question and an important one to answer. So those are the first things I'd want to know. Where are you from? What are your motives? And then thirdly, how long have you been around? What's your history? What do you like? How's your society organized? And so forth and so on. The same questions you'd ask if you were exploring some part of the world which, as a tourist, you hadn't visited, or which maybe a century ago, as an explorer, you hadn't even discovered yet. So those are interesting questions, but they're social questions. They're the kinds of things you'd want to ask in the context of talking to people who you more or less trust and who you're willing to have an open exchange with. And I hope we have that chance.
The book is called UFOs, ETs, and Alien Abductions. It's written by Don Crosby, Don Darien. Don, I thank you very, very much for taking the time to be on the program with us.
You're quite welcome.
Don Crosby, Don Derry, author of UFOs, ETs, and Alien Abductions. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0195. And you'll find links to Don's site, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob DiRico-Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. As the creator of the Wacky Warning Label contest, every year I ask Americans to look for funny product warnings about things that are common sense, like the label on a scooter that warns, "This product moves when used." So it may surprise you to learn that one of the funniest and seemingly most common sense warnings we get each year is a label that we've never used in the contest. It's often found on a bag of peanuts and says, "Warning, contains nuts." Pretty funny, but the catch is that peanuts are actually not nuts. They're part of the bean family, so many people with nut allergies can eat peanuts with no problems at all. But if the peanuts are processed with machines that also handle nuts, it can mean big trouble for people with nut allergies. So, in those cases, that warning makes sense. Let's be fair. The lawsuits we talk about here every week can be pretty nutty, but sometimes the funny labels aren't so nutty after all. Learn more about our contest. Visit us at centerforamerica.org.
Latitude, 47 degrees, 14 minutes north. Longitude, 84 degrees, 39 minutes west. Location, Montreal, Canada. This is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. It's time to crack a spine. The Stuff File presents Book Banter with Stuart Nauman. Once again, here's Peter Anthony Holder.
And yes, the next voice you hear will be that of Stuart Nauman. Another edition of Book Banter. Hello, Stu.
Hello, Peter. Oh, I'm getting nostalgic for the old clickety-clack, actually.
The old clickety-clack?
Yeah, the old-fashioned typewriter.
Oh, typewriters, yes, yes. Yeah. Know your home row.
Yeah, you remember those.
Of course.
Those Underwoods. The reason I'm feeling so nostalgic of hearing the clickety-clack of typewriter keys and, you know, putting the piece of paper in the carriage is on this edition of Book Banter, where I'm going to review a memoir of a TV writer who used a typewriter quite a lot, actually.
Well, by the way, I prefer Royals and Remingtons to Underwoods, just thought I'd let you know that.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Oh, okay. Well, you know, I never had one of those, but I had a brother, actually.
I had one of those, too.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Oh, really? Well, you know what? The reason I'm saying is because for three decades, the team of Frank Pepiat and John Aylesworth, they ruled the world of TV variety show genre as one of its most prolific in-demand writer-producers. These Toronto natives had the good fortune of churning out scripts and creating and producing TV variety shows and specials for some of the biggest names in show business during the period from, let's say, the 1950s up until the mid-70s. That includes Judy Garland, Steve Allen, Frank Sinatra, Jonathan Winters, Perry Como, Julie Andrews, Sonny and Cher, and Andy Williams. And not to forget 1969, in response to CBS's requests for the duo to create a summer replacement series to fill the time slot left vacant by the Smothers Brothers, who got canceled by the network, they decided to exploit the rising popularity of country music in America at the time, combine it with comedy, and make a variety series that would reach middle America. And you know what the end result of that was?
Uh-oh. Let me guess. Hee-haw?
Yeah, you got it.
So what you're saying is this is the guy we have to blame for Hee-haw.
Yes, afraid so. But, Frank Pepiat, who was half really responsible for that, he died of cancer last November. He recalls his fascinating and somewhat envious career as a successful TV comedy writer-producer during the golden age of variety in his highly entertaining memoir, When Variety Was King. He traces his humble beginnings during the late 40s and early 50s as a copywriter and production assistant in the radio department at McLaren Advertising, which was the largest advertising agency in Canada. And when the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation was about to start its TV network in 1952, the nascent TV network called upon Pepiat and Aylesworth to write and act in comedy sketches for a late-night variety show called After Hours. The show began to attract a loyal following very quickly for the duo sketches that featured their unique brand of offbeat, off-the-wall humor. Now, the lure of American TV and the big money it paid hit Pepiat and Aylesworth in the mid-50s when they were asked by Steve Lawrence and Edie Gourmet to be the main writers for their summer replacement series. And throughout the next 2.5 decades, the biggest names in the New York and Hollywood television worlds asked for Pepiat and Aylesworth if their variety specials or series need to be created, spruced up, or scripts needed some serious doctoring. And, you know, when you're dealing with some of these big A-listers and you know, working on all these TV variety shows, you have to have, a lot of great stories. And Pepiat is not afraid to share this wealth of stories in his book, which is what makes it so immensely appealing. Like, for example, one of my favorites is the time when they were hired by Judy Garland to be the writers on her ill-fated variety series. And they were invited to a party at Judy's house. And they were told to arrive around 7 o'clock, 7-ish. And them being good Canadians, they arrived just before 7, only to find out that Judy and her guests didn't arrive till about 8 o'clock.
Hmm.
Yeah, exactly. So the only person they managed to find in the house, who was also dating Garland at the time, was fellow Canadian Glenn Ford, who was sitting on the couch reading a script. So when Pepiat greeted Ford as a fellow Canadian, Ford just practically ignored him and went back to reading a script.
Well, that sounds rather un-Canadian, doesn't it?
Yes, not the usual warm, friendly manners that we're all associated with.
Unless, of course, he has a hockey stick in his hand.
I don't think he did.
Okay.
Another one. Not that was before the Los Angeles Kings were born, so I don't think so.
Okay.
So besides the generous helpings of anecdotes, Pepiat also describes the pressures he endured while trying to keep up with the everyday the everyday work of trying to write scripts and produce variety shows on a budget and how it played havoc with his personal life. But When Variety Was King is an enjoyable look back at a long-lost TV genre from behind the typewriter of a hairy, talented, humble Canadian writer who modestly carved a niche for himself as an unsung hero of the golden age of television, but a lot of fun and very few regrets throughout such an impressive showbiz career.
And the book again is?
It's called When Variety Was King by late Frank Pepiat. It's published by ECW Press and in 1795 available in trade paperback.
Now, you did mention that he was dying of cancer, that he did die of cancer. Was he aware that he was dying while he wrote this book?
Yes, he was, and he decided to get his story. He wanted to tell his story as soon as possible. So, yes, he was very ill when he put the book together. Now, a couple of books I'd like to recommend very quickly that deal with Pepiat and his contribution to TV. First, there's Andrew Clark's excellent book on the history of Canadian comedy called Stand and Deliver, in which there is a chapter about Pepiat and Aylesworth and their contribution to comedy, Canadian comedy in the early 50s. And mentions them, how they were working with the CBC back in, around 1952. And also a book called Rainbow's End by Coyne Stephen Sanders about the Julie Garland variety show that ran on CBS from 1963 to 64. And basically the argument was that, her show was doomed from the start.
Hmm.
So I recommend these books very highly. So and Pepiat is mentioned quite a bit in Rainbow's End as well.
Interesting stuff indeed, sir, as always. By the way, how can people find you?
Well, you could find me in print in the West End Times, published every Saturday. You can find me on paper. You can find me online at www.westendtimes.ca.
Thank you very much, sir.
You're welcome, Peter. Now, how do you put a piece of paper in this darn laptop? There's no place to put a piece of paper.
Yeah, that's always a problem. Stuart Nullman with another edition of Book Banter here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File.
And we're just about out of racetrack for this edition of the Stuff File program. We do indeed have an idiot of the day coming your way, but I've got a couple more Stuff File news stories right here, right now. Perhaps it's not a good idea after a night of drinking vodka that you decide to learn at that moment how to handle a gun. A Delaware County, Pennsylvania woman was charged with the fatal shooting of her husband during what police say was her first gun lesson in the wee hours of Saturday. Michelle, age 42, and William Wanko, age 43, had been drinking vodka and lemonade for about 6 hours when she asked him to show her how to shoot a gun in case someone attempted to break into the house. He had owned guns for years, and it couldn't have been a worse time. It's a recipe for disaster, mixing guns and alcohol, according to Borough Police Chief John Egan. William C. Wanko died of a gunshot wound to the chest, and the manner of death was ruled a homicide, according to the Delaware County Medical Examiner's Office. Charged with involuntary manslaughter, aggravated assault, and possessing an instrument of crime, Michelle Wanko was released on $250,000 unsecured bail. The couple's young sons, aged 5 and 2, were at the home when the incident occurred and have been placed with relatives. Gee, do you think she was just learning, or she knew exactly what she was doing? And Wilfred Sophus, age 33, was jailed at the Orleans Parish Prisons in New Orleans, Louisiana, on domestic battery charges. His wife was granted a protection order. Sophus was warned that he would not or could not be allowed to attempt to contact her. Now, while in jail, a detective says Sophus continually tried to use the jailhouse phone to call his wife 139 times, enough for a charge of felony stalking. He started in municipal court, where he was about to go to trial, said Magistrate Judge Gerald Hansen, a criminal court judge. I was looking at 140 counts, and I am required to set a bond on each one. So he did, applying his standard bail amount of $10,000 for each charge, which, on top of Sophus's original bail totals, now come to a whopping $1.44 million. Wow, it's true. Jailhouse phone calls really are expensive, aren't they? You know, I almost made him the idiot of the day, but I didn't, although he was close. But right now, right here, this is the idiot of the day.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. The Stuff File presents the idiot of the day.
The Drug Task Force of Jackson County, Mississippi, arrested Henry Ha Nien, age 41, in April, as operator of a large marijuana grow house, a facility that would usually and normally reek of the distinctive pot fragrance. However, Nien had thought of that and tried to mask the smell, but chose the alternative scent produced by buckets full of what appeared to be human feces. Yeah. Now, why would someone think that the aroma of copious amounts of human feces would be less of a red flag than the smell of large amounts of marijuana? Well, one reason, and one reason only. He's an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program number 0195. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0195. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. And you can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as P.A. Holder. And don't forget to check out the Stuff File store, where you can purchase a plethora of Stuff File merchandise, from t-shirts to mugs to tote bags to mouse pads. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, streaming on PCJ Media and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on iTunes and Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. Bye-bye.
Experienced another edition of the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. Now, doesn't that make you feel all warm and fuzzy? Like watching puppies and kittens frolicking in a field of daisies. Like the smells coming from Grandma's kitchen. Like the hallucinogenics you took in the 60s and I'm taking right now. Hello, cartoon birdies. Perhaps I said too much. Anyway, you know what I mean. Let the glow wash over you and enjoy. Peace out.